Welcome to the XA Podcast, the show that brings together the people that foster inclusive innovation across Southeast Asia. My name is Belinda Ong, and I am the Managing Director of the XA Network. Every episode, one of XA's members will lead a fireside chat or panel discussion with other members, founders, or investors that have shaped the tech ecosystem in this vibrant region. If you like what we have to say, please follow or subscribe to our show. And do remember to tell your friends and rate us 5 stars so others like you can find and benefit from all of our great content. Show notes are linked in the episode description, and you'll find notes and additional resources there.
Welcome to another episode of the People and Talent series of the XA Podcast, where we bring together business leaders, people experts, and career growth specialists to share their insights and views on the latest talent trends, with an emphasis on the startup ecosystem in the Southeast Asia region. We bring ideas, trends, innovations, and expert viewpoints to help our listeners learn more about the opportunities and pitfalls in the people space. So, whether you're a startup founder, industry leader, people manager, or a job seeker, our series has something for you. My name is Sergio Salvador, and I am your host for the People and Talent series. In my day-to-day work, I lead a people team at Carsome, an e-commerce platform that provides efficient vehicle buying and selling services to individuals, dealers, and entities with a workforce of 5,000 amazing Carsomers. And now, on to today's episode.
All right, so today's guest is someone that I've been looking forward to talk to for a while. He's currently the Chief People Officer at Gojek, but he's also an ex-colleague and a good friend. We used to work together a couple of lifetimes ago, and our professional paths led us in different directions to end up in a very similar place. I am very, very pleased to welcome to the show today Sunil Sadlur, Chief People Officer at Gojek. Welcome, Sunil.
Hey, Sergio. Thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. Why don't we start by having a very quick introduction in your own words?
Sure. Professionally, I've been at the intersection of people, organization, and culture for about 21 years. I studied for it. I studied labor relations, and I spent the next 18 or 19 years in HR in different roles or in talent roles. So I'm what you call a lifer in people and culture roles. And I've had the distinct privilege of having the chance to have worked with some of the best companies in the world in different countries. I've worked in India, I've worked in the US, I've worked in the Philippines, I've worked all across APAC, Singapore as my home currently. And it's been a tremendous journey. Personally, I used to be, and you'll hear this a lot from me prior to my current role, I used to do a lot of things outside of work before the pandemic. I was an avid hiker and a volcano climber, not a mountain, volcanoes only. I used to collect comic books, and I'm still a very avid fan of animated shows and anime in general. I have a 2-year-old daughter, so she's definitely an addition in the pandemic and has made my life very interesting.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for that. And I have the impression, based on how you were talking about those hobbies of yours, right, that we could have a podcast episode of every single one of those, right, talking about your volcano climbing. I'm already very curious about it. Today, we're going to be focusing on your experience as a people leader, right? And just to start with, what is a chief people officer? Can we just cover that for a moment?
That's a fantastic question. Well, in the simplest of terms, it is what the chief HR officer used to be called. But as organizations have evolved over time, what that role has been expected to do and what people want the focus of that role to be has changed. And I think people is much more all-encompassing for what the role does. There are different formats to the role. You have the traditional just HR roles, but you have lots of chief people officers are also responsible for anything that touches the quality of experience of people in the organization. It could be whether workplace, it could be IT services, it could be HR processes, it could be business operations. So there's a wide swath. And I think what a chief people officer means is different for different organizations and at different points in their growth. But for the majority of the world, the chief people officer is what the chief HR officer used to be.
So for the most cynical of our listeners, wouldn't that be a glorified HR leader?
You could say that. Depends on how you define HR. I think, again, different organizations have defined human resources differently. I think the movement of the title from human resources to people shows a marked sort of psychological shift away from sort of an artifact mindset where you're managing things to a more experienced mindset where you're managing the experience of people. It brings into sharp focus how the organization uses its constituent members, less as resources and more as people.
What kind of focus, what kind of activities, projects are the ones that a chief people officer like yourself would be mostly focused on? And can you give us a few examples of things that you particularly have enjoyed doing in the past?
Absolutely. I think if you look at my role specifically right now, it covers the entire spectrum of activities, right, from sort of a hire to retire life cycle of employee activities, right? So I have a key role to play, or my team has a key role to play in how candidates experience us as an organization, how they experience us on onboarding when they first come on, and through the different transitions and milestones they experience within the organization, whether they take on new roles, they get promoted, they move to different countries, et cetera, all the way down to when they exit the organization. Hopefully they retire, but sometimes they move on to other opportunities. How do they experience the organization? So there's a compendium of experiences, and there is a strong need for a singular editorial voice of that experience, which manifests the culture of the organization. So one of the key ways anybody experiences in a very tangible way what the organization's values are through its people processes, because people processes are how you treat your people, how you manage them at very interesting moments in their life. And it's usually hyper-exaggerated emotional moments in their life. Like you've got a promotion, you're elated, you're having a tough performance review, you're dejected and you're questioning yourself, or you're moving on to a larger role and you're wondering how you can do this. These are all exaggerated emotional moments. And the care, sensitivity, and thoughtfulness that organizations invest in their people is usually reflected in their values. And those values manifest as processes, particularly people processes.
You've already brought up a couple of times a very interesting word, right? And I think you were also alluding to it in your explanation, the word culture. How do you see culture in organizations? What are your thoughts about it in general?
So culture is an interesting thing. In my entire career, I think I've heard hundreds of variations of definitions of what culture is. But I think the strictest sociological definition is this collection, a shared collection of habits, behaviors, beliefs. And I think if I take that definition at its very root, that's what it is. An organization, in a sense, is a micro community that operates within a larger community. So when you come into an organization or you're a member of this organization, you have to subscribe to certain very specific ways of thinking, believing things that are important. Is the customer important, or is something else, or is the inventory important, right? For example, is the process important, or is the outcome important? And depending on which organization you're in, which industry you're in, those things can vary. And I think that's the role people and culture teams or HR teams play, which is you take what's the desired culture, because there is obviously an organic culture, which is unintentional. It's formed. Anytime two people get together, there's culture there, right? Because they start forming a very unique pattern that's unique to them. Now, compound that by a factor of thousands of people or hundreds of people, you suddenly have a unique group that's behaving in a very unique set of ways against very unique belief systems. So some of that's codified and intentional. It's like, we want to put the customer first, for instance. Non-controversial, many companies have that as one of their values. That's codified and intentional. Some of it is unintentional, like whether you're direct or not. It's like, I'm going to give you feedback directly. Maybe that'll work extremely well in a culture like in Israel. It'll work very poorly in Japan to ensure that the person has saved their face and you get them the feedback, but in a less direct manner. So you have to operate within the bounds of the cultural context of that community. So what processes do and what organizational mechanisms do is take the intentional parts of the culture and codify them into hard actions. So a good example would be how you promote people. There are some organizations where it's a simple, the manager thinks you're ready for the next job, go for it. You're promoted, right? In other organizations, they're like, no, we want this to be a bit more of a committee-led process. We want consensus. We want to make sure that your manager and their peers feel like this person is ready for the next job. You certainly have now a democratization of that decision, and the power to make those decisions has been removed. So there's a reliance on process over the individual's judgment. So that's an example of a direct culture, which is more judgment-led. So you empower your managers and they can make all the decisions. And then you have a slightly more process-led organization where you say, yes, we value judgment, but we also want to get everyone else's point of view on this. So it manifests in different ways.
Right. And on that sense, right, you have been with Gojek for a few years now. And these years were of significant growth, right, for the company and, of course, increasing achievements and milestones in the company, right? How has this philosophy thinking about culture helped you kind of do your work with the organization from when you started, which was a much smaller organization in terms of employee size, you name it, right, to where it is today?
That's actually a really good question. I think if I were to say Gojek's superpower is a sense of purpose and impact it has, any person who's worked with us or interacts with us in any meaningful way will tell you instantly that they experience that sense of purpose and impact throughout the organization. So in a sense, I had it a little bit easy because I had core anchor. We always wanted to be relevant to our constituent base, whether it's the drivers, the merchants, the consumers who use our app, or anyone in the ecosystem that's affected by us. So that became the core sort of root of what we were building against. When I joined thinking, hey, it's Gojek, companies, everything you said, it's relatively small, it'll be exciting. But it was actually incredibly complex organization. The month I joined, I found out we had acquired nearly 18 companies in the preceding 2 years, and they were at varying stages of being integrated. So it was safe to say I walked into an organization which had many different cultures, which had many different ways of thinking about people and talent and what was more important and less important. And certainly many, many founders who had come on board as these companies had acquired or merged with us. So the important thing became less about, okay, what do we do about integrating these cultures, and more about how do we anchor all of us to the common mission and purpose? What is that common mission and purpose going to be? And that was a labor of love. It took the better part of 6 to 9 months to get to an agreement of all the key decision makers, key influential people in the organization to say, this is something we can get behind. This is something we can build, like the whole one Gojek identity. Because prior to 2019, we had local brands. We were in different countries, but we were in very local brands. Again, they were acquired or merged or partnered with. And in 2020, we made this big push to say, we're all going to be one Gojek and it's going to be one experience. And that became the plinth for people as well. It's like, if you're going, you can't be one sort of consumer brand and one technology product, one set of experiences for all your users and have like dozens of organizations operating their own way. So you have to integrate the people narrative and the people story as well. And that was the plinth we used to really rally everyone to, this is the way we will think about people and culture. So really putting in place ideal state processes that we felt addressed most needs, and then cajoling really people to adopt it. Like one of the things I'm very proud of is, barring things like budgets and compensation framework, which was kind of a top-down decision, everything else was a co-creation. How we constructed jobs, how we constructed levels, how org design happened, it was very much a co-creative effort through the organization. It took its time, but it was worth it. In about, I would say conservatively, about a year, we made about 90% of the changes we needed to make. I'm not going to say there were no challenges, there were plenty, but it was an amazing achievement that hundreds of people got together, aligned behind a mission and a vision, and try to figure out what is the best way to articulate that for the people. So in 2020, we introduced a new way of managing performance. We introduced a new job and career architecture. We introduced a new compensation framework. We introduced new levels and titles. So it was as you can imagine, and it was also the pandemic year. So it was a lot going on. So we had to switch to work from home, and for a company that's significantly feet on street as well, it was a big shift. So 2020 was like a pivotal moment for us.
I can see that. And one of the things that you touched upon is the in this tremendous growth that the company has seen, right? Part of that growth comes from adding X amount of people to the company, right? Bringing them in on hiring. And I believe that this is something that is important to many of those in our audience, right? Maybe they are looking at the same challenges. How do you go about hiring? We all know that talent has been difficult to come by most recently. Well, most recently, possibly in the last few years, right? There's the talk of a war on talent, if you want to put it that way. How do you go about it as an organization? What was your philosophy?
So in 2017, 2018, our hiring processes were very decentralized. So each team ran its own thing. And this is very common in early stage companies because you're optimizing for speed and agility over all else, because having that person, having that button seat, so to speak, has tremendous value, right, in terms of the outputs you can achieve. So asymmetrical impact to just having someone in role doing the thing. But as we grew bigger and as we started hiring a lot more people with similar skill sets, but at different points in their experience, it became interesting because we had to find ways to A, be more systematic about it, and B, more just consistent in the way we went out to market. Because prior to, and one of the ways we did that was we centralized the recruiting process. We hired a recruiting leader who's done a fantastic job over the last couple of years. And one thing that was important instantly was the way candidates were experiencing us was just super fragmented, because the hiring manager was driving the process. So if you had a very involved and a capable hiring manager, they got an excellent experience. If you had someone who's kind of drowning in work or is struggling to figure it out, they got a slightly worse experience than anyone else. And centralizing did a couple of things. I think one, it allowed us to manage the touch points with the candidates. So how candidates were reached out to was very standardized. We could raise the bar because we're using common templates to do these outreaches. We had a dedicated sourcing team. Recruiters were more able to share their pipelines with each other. So if team A had a good candidate, but they weren't quite a fit for that team, earlier we would have just dropped that candidate. But now with centralization, they're like, hey, look, this person's good. Maybe not in my team, but it may work for your team. So you started seeing the power of the team coming together. And that was step one. Step two was actually training hiring managers to ask structured standard questions. We didn't have codified hiring rubrics in all our functions. And that's partly because our jobs were not very well defined. Broadly, yes, you're like software engineer, but are you a back-end engineer? Are you a front-end engineer? Are you a UX engineer? Are you a test engineer? All of that was kind of process of discovery during the interviews. So when we introduced the new jobs and career architecture within the company, it became very clear that, okay, this is what different types of engineers do. This is what we should ask for questions. Like if you're a test engineer, do you have experience running automated test environments? If you're a product engineer, are you good at running experiments and iterating? And I think those became important and they fed into the hiring rubrics. What that did was it allowed us to ask highly standardized questions and get responses. So when we were comparing, and Gojek's a very democratic culture, it's very bottom up. So that means that when we do hiring, we do it in a panel. So it's not just one person, but like a panel of three or four interviewers. Even the size of the panel was a debate, right? Should it be 11 people? Should it be two people? Should it be one? Should it be four? We ended up with four. It's like your hiring manager, a functional expert. If you're in a people manager role, then someone who's either a people manager or an HR, and maybe one stakeholder from the business that you'll be working with or whose business you'll be impacting, right? So that became our panel. And I think what that did was, because we were asking highly, A, we were reaching out to candidates in a structured way. B, we were controlling the experience. We were sharing pipelines. And C, we were asking standard questions so we could compare candidates much more quickly. So it sounds like a lot of bureaucracy being put in place, but it actually accelerated a lot of stuff, because now you have standard things to do. Hiring managers don't have to wonder what questions to ask, which templates to use. So our throughput of hiring really increased a lot. So our capacity to hire or interview just went up tremendously. I think our recruiter productivity 2.5x'd in the span of 8 months, having introduced some of these processes, and then we frequently hired back in the day, at least 1,000 people a year. And that's not a small number for the kind of people we need to hire. And to address your question on the war for talent, I think there never was a patch in my career where there wasn't high demand for good people. Like there's always going to be high demand for good people.
Fantastic. Very, very helpful. Thank you. So that's very useful. We have discussed culture. We have discussed attracting people. We have discussed a little bit of the philosophy that you follow in your roles. We haven't discussed yet retaining, which is also important, especially during the pandemic itself. That challenged pretty much every single one of us, right? We're not quite even done yet, but thankfully things have got so much better already. But what did you observe, right, in terms of we all had to develop a level of resilience? What did you observe in your organization on how people dealt with it, how the organization supporting them? What can companies do when there is a crisis in order to support people?
I think that's a very good question. There were a couple of things. Again, this is me reflecting after the fog of war has cleared and I'm looking back on the year, but this was very much a process of discovery as we went through the journey. One of the things that was very important was getting everyone to look at the same facts and figures, because what can happen in organizations very quickly is you become led by narratives versus data. You say, oh, there's attrition everywhere. It's so hard. I can't do anything because the attrition's too high. And when you actually look at it, the attrition's in pockets, right? You're okay on the operations side. You're probably okay on your commercial teams. Attrition is probably concentrated in tech, but in this specific team, in this country, working on that product, we had to get really surgical about the way we framed our problem statements. The second thing is we've all known what it's meant to be a good team and sort of what it takes to retain people. We're very experience oriented as an organization, so we poll our employees nonstop. So there are quarterly pulse surveys, we ask surveys on experience during the performance management process, which is twice a year. We have an annual survey. After every key process like performance, promotion, et cetera, we send an experience survey. How did you feel about this process? So we have a ton of data, and that's something we do very, very religiously as an organization. When we looked at the data, it's been clear. People wanted career development, growth, the ability to see a future for themselves in the organization that was beyond just current job. Now, those top two or three categories haven't changed. And of course, compensation keeps going up and down. It's always there, but it keeps going up and down in priority and importance. So when we look at what we did as an organization, earlier, the quality of the feedback was, I don't know what to do beyond my job. Later, it became, okay, I know what to do, but I don't know how to go about it. And right. That's because as our processes and programs kept maturing, it now became, okay, I know what to do, I know how to do it, but I'm scared to make the transition. Who can I talk to? I'm looking for mentorship and coaching. And we found that largely in teams where managers were not doing hygiene things, like career development conversations, et cetera, that's where there seemed to be a spike. And we don't want to blame the manager when we look at why managers are not able to do those things. So yeah, we put these processes in place. I think teams that had lower adoption of those processes saw like an outlier amount of attrition. That's not to say that there weren't more macro issues, because we have a bulk of our team in India, Southeast Asia, and those markets saw an insane level of activity when it came to early stage company funding, which meant people were getting very, very generous offers and C-level titles at very early points in their career, which becomes very hard to compete with when you're at a certain scale and size. So I think we made a conscious call. So one was, what did we do as an organization? We got everyone to look at the data in very precise ways, and we reported on the data in very precise ways. So that helped narrow the problem statement and make it seem like it removed the perception that the whole company was on fire, that only there were pockets of fire. The second thing we did was we really doubled down on the hygiene factors. Earlier, there were optional things to do for managers. We slowly made it part of manager expectations to do IDPs, to do career development conversations, to have slightly more longer term things. We looked at structural things as well. We reduced friction in our internal transfers process. We had a fairly high friction process. You needed to get approvals, you needed to have a certain performance contribution score, et cetera. We changed all of that a little bit. So talent mobility became easier within the company. We responded to the feedback. These were things I would like to believe we would have done anyway without the attrition, but the attrition really has, the environment created a situation where gave us that extra motivation to get it done quickly. So our people have fewer things pushing them out of the company. We could do very little about the pull factor, but the push factor we could certainly address. That was the second thing. And the third thing we did was, as a leadership team, and this is the hardest thing to do, as a leadership team, it took about, I think, a quarter for all of us to accept that this is going to happen, and this is going to happen for a while, and that we just have to plan around it. And I think that was the hardest one to get to, because otherwise you feel this, as a leader especially, you feel very, very motivated to address the issue. And it's very easy to take attrition personally if you're leading an organization. So you're navigating those feelings and agreeing as a group that we had to work together and ride this out. And I'm really glad we did, because attrition has fallen. It's going back to pre-pandemic levels. We had very low attrition always, even through the peak of it. I was talking to colleagues and I was actually mildly glad that our attrition was lower than our peers in the market. So
fantastic. Well, I think we have time for a couple of short questions more. And I guess the first one will be, obviously you work now, you're the chief people officer for a very large organization. But as I like to remind people, Even Google, Amazon, and Microsoft were startups at some point. Right? So would you have any brief thoughts for early stage company founders, right, that are starting to think about the people aspect of their organizations?
I would say my number one advice is to keep your talent bar incredibly high for as long as possible. The first 100 to 200 people in your organization will make the culture, and they have an outsized impact on the culture. So have a very high bar on the people you've hired, the behaviors you expect of them, and their level of commitment to the organization. My favorite story from when I was at Google is most of the first 100 employees are still there after all these years. A few left, but majority are still there. And that's a huge signal and indicator. That's advice number one. As long as possible and as much as possible, stay involved in the hiring process, in the selection, and in the evaluation space for those people, for your first 100 to 200 people. That's very, very important. It's painful in the beginning, but you'll thank yourself for doing it later. The second thing is, there's a disease of best practice, thoughtless best practice adoption. Just because successful company does things a certain way in the talent space, you're like, the belief is if we do the same thing, we will have similar outcomes. It is very pervasive, especially with younger founders or earlier stage companies. Very tempting because it's a successful model. What you have to realize is people processes follow a certain maturity curve. You don't need everything all at once. And certainly if you're pre-product market fit, you don't need very much. You just need a very good selection and hiring process. And you need very good sort of role management within the organization, so you don't have too much overlapping roles and responsibilities. That's about it. Everything else can just be because you're going to be iterating, you're going to be, you know, just experimenting. You're going to try and fail a few times, and don't get committed to a structure too early on. But once you've hit product market fit and you're confident in product market fit, then it's a question of scaling. That's when all the formal processes kick in. And it's like, okay, I need like 20 marketing people. I need 100 operations people. I need 50 engineers. Like that's when things become, then you're solving scale problems. Then you start introducing formal systems. Don't be in a rush to introduce process to manage people too soon. Wait for the critical moment. Don't wait till it's breaking. Have a good sense of when your system is running out of bandwidth to do things, and then start institutionalizing mechanisms. And if you've done the right thing hiring smart people, you won't have too much to worry about in terms of rules and regulations.
Fantastic, Sunil. Maybe a bit of a last question for you, perhaps more of a recommendation. Would you happen to have a book that perhaps you have read recently that you have enjoyed that you might recommend to our audience?
That's a tricky one. I think if you're an early stage company and you're a founder or you're part of the founding team, I would strongly recommend reading this mildly cynical book. It's called The Dictator's Handbook. It's written by two Stanford political science academes. And why I say that book is because incentives, structure, and power play very outsized roles at earlier stage companies and smaller organizations. It's very important for everyone to understand the flow of those three things, the interplay of those three things. And this book does an amazing job explaining it. I personally still go back to it quite
fantastic.
Often.
The Dictator's Handbook. It sounds very promising. I'm already looking for it for my Kindle. Well, Sunil, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. Really appreciate it. I have learned myself a lot. And listen, thank you so much again.
Thanks, Sergio. Thanks for having me on.
Before we close, as a reminder, show notes are available on the link in the episode description. So do click through to get a summary and related resources. We hope you liked the episode as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. And if you did, please do spread the word about our podcast and take a second to rate us 5 stars. Thank you for joining us today. This was Belinda with the XA Podcast. See you next time.